Welcome to Theatre Voice, the V&A's archive of conversations with leading theatre practitioners. I'm Tim Bano, editor of Theatre Voice. Last year, the greatest lighting designer in Britain announced that she was going to retire. Paulie Constable has not only won a ridiculous number of awards, she's also shaped the look of contemporary theatre in the country through her work on stage, which covers every show you've ever heard of, from Warhorse to Les Miserables to Oliver to Wolf Hall to Angels in America, and also through her unwavering advocacy for lighting designers, for theatre and for women in the profession. She has the rare ability to explain what lighting design does and what it can and should do in a way that makes complete sense of the art form. In this interview, she talks about what led to her decision to retire and what will come next. Paulie, thanks so much for talking to me for Theatre Voice. I want to start kind of at the end because very recently you announced your retirement, which I think sort of surprised a lot of people in the industry. You are an absolute titan in this industry, by a long shot, the most successful lighting designer in this industry, one of the, you know, just most brilliant people. What prompted that decision and how's it been since then?
Tim, two things. One, it's lovely to be here. And also, thank you so much. That's sort of slightly overwhelming. What prompted it? There's so many things that meant this felt like the moment for me. I have always promised myself that I would stop doing this thing that I love so much while I still love it. And I think that's so important. Of course, one of the problems with the jobs that we all do in theatre is that our love makes us vulnerable. But I do, you know, I stumbled into this world. I absolutely fell down the rabbit hole, discovered my people, discovered a way that I could be creative, discovered so many things that I didn't know were there for me. It's been such a joyful ride. So yes, wanting to stop while I still have huge love for it in my heart. Mm. Having a moment where I think because of the advocacy work I did for freelancers through the pandemic, I had a very, very busy pandemic and I've carried on that work post-pandemic and I found coming back to work quite difficult. And I thought I'd slightly kind of test for myself if it felt like the right moment. And so I sort of mentally tested what would happen if I stopped. And I thought the big thing is that I thought I've got an amazing sort of body of work. I've been so privileged to be in the rooms that I've been in. So much of what I've done, of course, is joy, is creativity, is so many things, but it's also competitiveness with myself. And I thought, actually, I feel really ready to stop constantly trying to test and judge myself. And that's my stuff, you know, that's. And then there's the other aspect of, you know, with all the conversations about diversifying our industry and things, I genuinely think I've loved working and nurturing the young talent with and nurturing the young talent I've got to know. I think it's their time. And I think that our industry has to change and evolve and develop and grow and also sort of almost refind its love for itself. And, you know, I have a nostalgia for the world where I made Follies.
Yeah.
The world where I made Curious Incident. The world we are in now is very, very different. And I actually think that nostalgia is in some way, I need to kind of liberate myself and the industry from that. And, you know, I'm sort of trying to kind of square new technology, new ideas, new influences into my work, but with a sense of I came into a very different world. And I think my experience is useful to a certain point. And then I think, actually, I want to be excited by the next generation.
That's really, really, I mean, there's so much to think about there. The nostalgia thing is fascinating because talking about Follies, that was 2017. I mean, that's less than a decade ago. It's, you know, to me, that still feels like a new production. Mm. And yet, you know, time slips away. It's a kind of crazy that it can have a sense of nostalgia attached to it. But then you think about how much the world has changed, how much the industry has changed. It is. It's a lot. I mean, I was talking to someone recently, a producer who was just saying they are terrified that the next generation might not be there actually because there's this huge kind of black hole in the mid-scale. Yeah. And, we're slowly aging out the people who have been allowed to you know have those formative experiences to get up to the top of their game. I mean, you do a huge amount of work with younger artists and nurturing and supporting them. I mean, how are you seeing that? Are you seeing that there is work there for them? Are you seeing that they have the resources? Are you seeing that there is the talent there?
I think what I've always looked for in people when I meet them is talent and appetite and curiosity.
Hmm.
I think one of the luxuries of the world that I grew up in is that I didn't need to want to work at the National Theatre. It was the last place in the world that felt relevant to me as a young sort of technician, developing designer. I wanted to meet people and make good work. But of course, the financial pressure on me living in London in the kind of late 80s, early 90s was very different to the reality now. And there's been a real push to kind of professionalize our industry as well. You know, this whole kind of thing about define ourselves through data, make ourselves look more professional, more serious, more entrepreneurial. And I just really worry that what that removes is the spark. So somehow, you know, I there are really brilliant people out there, and I've met some gorgeous young ones, and they're doing really, really well. But somehow, you know, how we nurture that spark and also feel a sense of progression, because I think so often with somebody who's a young, kind of exciting designer, everyone goes, great, you're the next new thing. And you can see them getting crushed by the expectation. You know, what you need as a designer is you need to develop in a way where you can find your own voice. You can find who you are creatively. And it's a very vulnerable world to do that in. So for me, I'd found collaborators who I just loved and who helped me to become a designer. You know, somebody who wasn't frightened to kind of have a voice and express and feel I had agency in a room. And I've been very lucky that a lot of those individuals went on to be successful. So people like Marianne and I met really, really early doors, worked at the Royal Exchange together. You know, Rufus I met early, Katie Mitchell, Simon McBurney, you know, we were all kids.
Yeah.
And somehow, I think what you're talking about that hollowing out of the industry, which of course has happened through the pandemic and is happening throughout the, you know, from technical skills, backstage skills to so much of it, where we've lost those people. And we've lost the spaces where people can be vulnerable and can learn.
Yeah. I think you're right about that thing as well. We're so desperate for it not to be the case that when we do see someone successful at the start of the career, there is that kind of latching on and being like, you are the next big thing. Let's overexpose you. Let's, you know, make the second show and the third show and the et cetera, which are the really, really hard ones.
Yeah.
Let's make them really public and put a lot of pressure on you and a lot of scrutiny. And yeah, not having that room to experiment and fail, I think is really interesting.
And also room to surprise people. I think what happens quite often is that you do one thing that's very successful and then people just want you to do that thing.
Yeah.
And I remember even with Complicité, when I did Street of Crocodiles, I remember going and taking on a job out of London. And clearly in the end, the director wanted me to make the show into a Complicité show. And you go, no, that's all about collaboration and conversation. And I'm just one tiny cog in a much larger machine. And it's the machine that's interesting. It's the kind of participation in the conversation that's interesting, not what I can impose on it.
Mm. I think that leads to something quite interesting as a lighting designer as well, which is about how you have an individual style versus being part of the collective that theatre always is. You know, I've talked to you before. I feel like I have a bit of a sense of your style, which is, and you, please correct me if I'm wrong.
No. I love it.
But to me, it feels like use the least amount of light you need. So you start from pitch black and you, I think you explained this to me, and then you turn it up until you've just got enough. Mm. And I think darkness is a huge part of your lighting, which, you know, to people who don't really know about lighting design might seem a bit counterintuitive. Is that broadly speaking right? And B, where did that develop, if it is right, that style?
So the answer to A is I'm thrilled. Yes, totally. I'm terrified of the dark. I'm deeply claustrophobic, and I think that's where a lot of my kind of creative sort of where I hold the conversation is around that point of fear. And I met a painter recently who asked me what my hierarchy was. What does that mean? And I said darkness. You know, I think I definitely tend to carve out of darkness rather than to use light as a noisy thing. So I love the fact that you see that and kind of can see what that means. Where did that come from? I mean, I often think about this, that, I mean, I think it partly comes from growing up in a world without huge resource. So, you know, trying to achieve a lot with very little. And I think it comes from, you know, my background, my degrees in English literature. So I actually have a deep love of practical criticism, and I love breaking things down into their essence. But I also love the idea of creating a structure for what I do, and a kind of, call it a series of rules, if you like. And most of my shows are based on one or two ideas. That's enough, you know, and then you explore them and keep turning them the other way around and look at their different facets. So I think there's a kind of mixture of being an English academic, being somebody who sort of, also I have great respect for light. I think the fear of the dark also means that I really value it. But also I know that one way to control my fear can be a tiny amount of light, can do a huge amount for me personally. So I think it's naturally in me. I think it's my sort of journey led me that way. And then I think the other thing I sometimes think about is, obviously I've been quite involved in the sustainability conversation around the industry. And I wonder which came first. My aesthetic is quite Amish. You know, I like quite a pure, clear, I don't like clutter. I don't like clutter in my own life. I mean, look at the space I'm in, this kind of white space. I don't like cluttered spaces. I don't like arbitrary, you know, so all of that sort of leads me to kind of, I love kind of applying that to sustainability and kind of going, actually, as a designer, the best thing you can do in terms of sustainable practice is to value light as an element that's sort of vulnerable and that we sort of hold with care. So, and I wonder which came first. Did I develop that aesthetic because I was interested in sustainability, or has that aesthetic fed into my sustainable kind of concerns? And I think it's the latter. I think my natural kind of need to create order amongst chaos, to calm things.
It's, what do you sort of feel when you see lighting designs that are saturated in colour and are kind of full of busyness and movement and motion? You know, is that something that you aesthetically don't enjoy, or is that something that you can kind of enjoy in other designs? It's just not something that feeds into your own designs. And I'm not saying your designs don't have colour in, because they absolutely do as well.
I mean, I remember going to see Hamilton that Hal Binkley lit, and I wrote to him afterwards, and I said, it's almost like I'm riding a bicycle and you're knitting a jumper. It's like we're doing two totally different things. And, you know, Hal was very, very good at the thing that he did. For me personally, it's not a thing that creatively, it doesn't sort of land for me. And it sort of doesn't earn its place, but it's totally right for what they were aiming for. And I think when you're in safe hands like that, as you always were with Hal, you can't help but respect it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, I think in a way, the sad thing for me is that so many people assume that a musical has to look a certain way, or an opera has to look a certain way. And you go through the process and let it reveal itself. And I mean, that's one of the things I've loved about my relationship with Cameron, is that, you know, he loves the fact that I woefully underlight everything I do. He really enjoys that sculpted, picked out, very kind of oil painting like aesthetic that is in Les Mis now, and actually is in Oliver as well.
Definitely is in Oliver. I was going to bring that up, because, so, you know, Oliver is in the West End at the moment when we're having this conversation. Mm. And I saw it in Chichester, but that's a really good example of lighting that you might not expect for that musical in that place. You know, you might expect it to be polychromatic, big kind of panoply of colours and stuff. And actually, that wasn't the vibe that Cameron and Matthew Bourne and that whole team were going for at all, was it? It was that kind of, can you just explain a bit about what the approach was? Because I think there was some kind of homage being paid to the original production designs in that.
I mean,
that
show. It's interesting how everyone has picked up on the influence of Sean Kenny, who was the original production designer, because Les, I think, knew those designs, but he really didn't reference them.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But I think the main thing for Matthew and Les was taking the show back to the spirit of Stratford East and the idea of making a show in front of an audience. So conjuring in a way, and conjuring in a kind of Victorian sort of, I mean, as much as we could with Cameron, obviously, there's a poor theatre aesthetic to it. It's not all delivered scenically and in a complete and whole way. So it leaves, what I love about doing work like that is it leaves the audience's imagination to participate in what you're doing.
Yeah.
But I think it's really fascinating how I'd love to be able to sit Sean Kenny and Les Brotherston down next to each other and talk about their two processes that led them to this point, because there are unquestionably similarities, but I also think the similarities sit in the source material.
Yeah.
You know, you go back to Oliver Twist, and the descriptive passages in Oliver Twist are just, you know, I think they give you everything you need to like that show.
Mm. That's really interesting. So kind of Dickensian descriptions of London and you can kind of sense the light in those descriptions.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of our kind of reference to things like that is things like painting, obviously, but also films that have, you know, because a lot of our sense of what the past looks like are governed by the images that were presented now of that. So, you know, we have a kind of whole Merchant Ivory aesthetic for the kind of Raj period, or, you know, or the Edwardian England and that sort of thing. And you go, what was it actually like versus, and of course they're beautifully observed, but not actually observed, beautifully sort of discovered and rediscovered. And we're doing that same thing, aren't we? We're interpreting history through a lens that has kind of seen contemporary sort of versions of it themselves.
Well, also, I think as well that there is, as well as there being a kind of set of expectations about how certain periods in time should look or how certain genres should look, there's also an expectation about how certain types of theatre should look, how commercial West End musicals should look.
Yes, totally.
And actually trying to challenge that, I think, is a really, really good thing as well.
Oliver was actually the first show I ever did for Cameron, which when they revived the Sam Mendes production at Drury Lane and Rupert Gould directed it. And I remember trying to put my team together to do that because I'd never done anything big and commercial before. And one of the production managers said to me, you know, did you feel kind of left out by this kind of club of the West End and big commercial musicals? And I said, the brilliant thing about stepping into this space in my 40s is that nobody's going to expect me to make it look anything other than something I've done. I'm not some 30-year-old designer who's been given this opportunity and who therefore feels I need to please 1,000 masters. I have a style and I have a voice. And if anybody invites me into the room, that's what I bring with me. Mm. And that's not right for everybody. And what's been a joy is Cameron, you know, and his team love that.
Can we talk a bit about some of the practicalities of working on shows? And, you know, just for people who, again, I think it's always, I'm sure you're completely aware of this when you're talking about what you do, that there are just so many people who just don't know what it involves to be a lighting designer. But just some of the basics. Generally speaking, how far into the process are you brought on board? At what point do you get involved?
Generally, I will always tend to leave a director and designer to create their sort of first pitch of what they want to do, the world, the kind of, and sometimes you've had conversations before, quite often with a director, if they're asking you to do a project, you sort of explore what that might mean or what they're expecting you to bring with you. But once they've done what they call a white card model, which is quite often sort of a few meetings that they'll have, and that amazing alchemical moment that I really don't understand, when a designer takes a bunch of conversation and makes it into a three-dimensional thing. So, you know, they might have said, we're doing Lab OM and we decided we're going to set it on the moon. So here's a model of a kind of idea of a moonscape or something. And at that point, I tend to come and join in the conversation and have a kind of, the big questions I ask is like, what with that provocation, what's going to make light walk into the room? So if you think about a show like Curious Incident, The Dog in the Night, Bunny had this idea when we originally did the show about doing it on a piece of black graph paper with some light boxes around the edge. And then through the workshops and her presenting that, you know, there became this, and reading the book, you sort of think, oh, there's this whole thing about diagrams and about, you know, wiring and space. And I think Christopher would love show lighting as well. So then we sort of developed this further. So light became embedded in that world. We created lights throughout the set, what we called the pixels, that kind of lit up in each corner of the graph paper. Mm. So we could draw diagrams, and then we sort of started to think of the world of video. So it does tend to be quite early on with me. Mm. And I think that's why quite often I fold lighting into the sort of DNA of the production, the kind of question of how light walks into the room in a way.
What are you able to do at that stage before you've got into the theatre? What is it that you're able to do? Are you imagining it in your head, or are you, I don't know, doing technical things that I don't know about?
It's such a terrible leap of faith, because everybody has the opportunity to try what they're doing. So a costume designer will do, you know, sketches and then try them on singers or performers. And a set designer has a model and then goes to see it in the workshops. For me, I talk a lot. You know, I'll kind of talk a lot about ideas and sort of try and mentally explore ideas of like, oh, if we're doing that, then I think the light should frame the space like this. Or if we're doing this, then I don't think we should see any lights. I think but essentially you're kind of on your own, because you're not actually going to be able to deliver anything until you're in the theatre. And by that point, you have done all the technical drawings. So we work in 3D in sections and plans, work out where you want to put the lights, hired the lights if it's a commercial production, had them, you know, built the infrastructure that will hold the lights. You know, all of these quite terrifying things that are big commitments of time and money for something that you cannot see until you're sitting in the theatre. So when we sit in a theatre and we start teching a show, I'm the element that nobody's seen yet.
Mm.
And also there are no rules about lighting. So other than light travelling in straight lines, how light meets a person, a surface, a shape, a space, you can work that out on paper, but you've not got no idea of what the quality of that light meeting those objects, interacting with that space. You've got no idea of what that's actually going to look like until you're doing it. So it's blind faith, which is also why I talk about managing fear a lot.
But how, I mean, presumably experience, you know, plays a lot, a big part in, you know, you become experienced at different spaces, different people, different types of lights, and how it might. So presumably over time you do, the surprises are fewer, but are there, I mean, it sounds like there are still surprises. Once you get
I think the fear gets worse, actually.
Really?
And that could actually feed into part of our initial conversation about one of the reasons to stop, or certainly step off the treadmill, is that the fear is addictive, you know, but the fear is also profound.
Really?
And I do feel, and I don't know whether this is the true for everybody, but I certainly feel the way that I engage, in the way that I like to make shows, I like risk. I like to surprise. I don't want to sit back on what I know. I want to explore the decisions I'm making. And the most creative work does come out of that leap of faith, in a sense. So yeah, I think there's something, the advantage of experience is I panic less when it's bad, because I feel I can, you know, try and find my way to kind of perhaps mitigate or kind of turn it round, or and I think that I have been in more situations where I've anticipated things that could be problematic, but I also feel the fear of getting it deeply wrong is very, very present.
When does that fear start and when does it abate?
The really dark time for me is, so you have this lovely model process and you get to know a piece and you plan everything and sort of work it out with technical drawings and sort of, you know, very similar to architects' drawings that involve lighting, and you can do an element of computer modeling, but again, it's quite a rudimentary tool. And you develop like practical objects that can light up and come into the space, and you watch rehearsals. And then when you start in the theatre making a show, there's a period where generally in rehearsals, the director is doing their last runs and they're kind of preparing and everyone's exciting and like excited. Oh, we're going on stage. So their kind of wave of excitement is coming at you. And I have to do this thing where all the lights go up in the air or wherever they're going. And I have to go and focus, point the lights in the right place and start trying to make something which everyone else has had months to work on. And I've been working on it virtually for months, but I haven't been working with it. There's been nothing tangible. And I generally have 2 or 3 days of deep existential trauma. And the first session where you have the cast on stage with costume and everything is generally the time when you can see if it's going to be all right or not.
That's quite, I mean, it's weird because 2 or 3 days is, it's a tiny, tiny amount of time to be able to get a show on its feet in the space, but it's also quite a long time to subject yourself to that kind of intense fear.
Yeah.
how do you negotiate those two things, I guess?
Well, I run a long way.
Okay.
You know, I do
literally run.
Yeah, I literally run in the mornings before I go to work, partly because I know I'm going to spend the rest of the day in a dark space, so I need to get outside, but I run to clear my head, to manage my stress. And also, I mean, it's interesting you talking about what the process is like. I'm in the very privileged position, particularly if I'm doing a commercial project, where I can sort of pick and choose a team to work with. Mm-hmm. And I have some really trusted colleagues who are really good at their jobs, but are very funny. There's a huge amount of gallows humour, I'm afraid. It's being able to sort of acknowledge when it's terrible, being able to feel vulnerable with people is really, really important. Trusted collaborators. I know that we all need to diversify the pool of who we're working with, but there is also something so important about trusted creative colleagues who you can make mistakes with and you don't feel judged for them. But yeah, terrible jokes, lots of running and food.
It's good solutions to everything, I think, really. For a long-running show, if you think about Les Mis, how often do you have to go in and tweak things? Because does the lighting have to change? You know, for example, if a new cast comes in, the way that the light might hit them, or that kind of thing.
Well, there's a complicated answer to that, which I'll come on to, actually. I mean, basically, with something like, if you imagine Les Mis in London is quite a good example. I have an absolutely brilliant associate who is UK-based on Les Mis, who originally worked on the technical team, on the lighting team for Les Mis when we first made this version. And over the years, he became one of the programmers, and now he's an amazing associate. He's got the DNA of the show under his skin. So he watches the show every 4 to 6 weeks and will generally communicate with the rest of the team, the resident director, the kids director, people like that. If something isn't quite landing properly, give notes, keep an eye on the focus being right, the follow spot's doing a good job. Just make sure that the show is robust. And Simon's also amazing for kind of, we've over the years evolved the show into being what is an LED rig, so a more contemporary lighting rig than it was when I first did it. And then if I'm available, I will always, when there's a cast change or something like that, I'll always spend a bit of time with him and the show partly to plug into him and his show knowledge. And also, if there are any bigger things, we go, oh, you know, we did the 40th anniversary recently. And I said to him afterwards, in December, when we've got a moment, I think we should come back and look at the battle sequences, because I think they're looking a bit old. And I think we need to have a new look at them. And so I constantly check in, but Simon is the everyday check-in. I mean, the thing that has become brilliantly a more complicated question is that of different skin tones in different roles. So we've just had a global majority Javert. We've got the same with Oliver happening at the moment. And there's a kind of moment where you need to go in and check that we are supporting that individual to the best of our ability. But at the same time, it's really complex if you start making a different version of the show for every different possibility of who could be playing what role. So I've sort of landed on the fact that we can only respond to the show in front of us, and that essentially if there's a problem, it's quite often going to be a universal problem, and actually we need to support that character better rather than purely going, this is a black performer and therefore that's a problem. But, you know, we are learning as we go in that conversation, because it's very complex.
Yeah, I mean, that is incredibly interesting. I guess that sort of speaks as well to some of the big changes that you must have seen in the industry over the years, at the way that, you know, it's a long way to go, but the way that maybe we are supporting global majority performers a bit more in roles. I mean, is that true in any sense behind the scenes as well? Have you seen that change?
Of course, it is true behind the scenes, but it's much, much, much slower. And I think there's a complicated, I think generally around this question, there's a complicated issue of what we're asking of people.
Yeah.
That I think quite often, you know, I'm old enough to sort of work out what the demand of a show is going to be on me. But also, I'm very habitually, I try and solve the problems I anticipate myself. And I think one of the things about the younger, newer generation is they are seeing the problems as problems and exposing them as that, rather than someone like me, who, with all my white privilege, can kind of go, I can choose to put myself through this and cope. So, you know, and I also think there are many roles in backstage and creative disciplines that are very complicated in terms of servant-master relationships, for example. You know, dressers are required to serve in a certain way. I think dressers can be treated and should be treated with extraordinary respect, because performers cannot do what they want to do without that level of support. It's all of it is about mutual respect and collaboration. But unfortunately, we work in a system which is much more hierarchical, and that is very exposed when you start looking at racism.
Yeah.
So it's really, really complicated. And I think we can only really start to make that space okay for everybody, particularly individuals from the global majority, if we're really honest about what's complicated about the space. And I don't think that's been done enough.
Yeah, because the theatre, you know, as much as it has changed, it's still one of those worlds which is very steeped in its long-established traditions and rituals, and which people are very reluctant to change and address as well. I mean, it's interesting, I was listening to an interview that you did, I think it was really recent actually, where you talked about an experience of actual overt misogyny as well in the room. And that was pretty shocking, hearing that, you know, from in the last couple of years.
Oh, I've just had it in the last few weeks with the management. I mean, actually, this one's not in the UK, but trying to define the terms whereby an opera from the UK could go to a house elsewhere. And, you know, as ever with European opera houses, the ask is ridiculous. And, you know, one of the liberating things about retiring is I'm going, this is what you need to do in order to deliver this. And their response is that clearly I'm not up to, obviously she's very slow.
Wow.
And I'm, wow. You know, I don't think they would say that, you know.
Yeah.
I really don't think that. But yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking as well, I just watched the Michel Hussain, Nigel Farage.
Oh, I can't remember myself.
I mean, it's just, it's being unleashed again as well. You know, Trump is, I think it's really interesting. I think in all the times through my career, Tim, I think that there are directors I know and love and who I've worked with frequently, but who I am so often, despite my gender, chosen by them.
That's interesting. But what sort of makes you want to carry on working with them then?
I think part of that is that competitive thing that I believe that I can prove them otherwise. I can believe if I can normalize that, if I can change their natural sense that whoever should be driving this room, because in a tech, the lighting designer is in a position where they can really drive. And, you know, if they can accept that they turn around and look at the person driving, and quite often I think they do want to feel secure that that's a man in control. And with me, they look over and it's Lieutenant Uhura. You know, she was my childhood hero. You know, she was kind of keeping her head on that bridge with all those men flying around and things.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Great, you know.
Brilliant, yeah.
But there's an element of that that I don't know whether you can have this in the podcast, but it's a massive element of fuck you from my life, I'm afraid.
I do find that fascinating because it's obviously completely irrational, as so many kind of ingrained forms of bigotry are. But it feels so of another era as well. Like it does seem surprising, I think, to someone on the outside that it's still entrenched, that it's still there.
I think it's still deeply entrenched. Yeah, I really do.
What do you say to, you do a lot of mentoring and nurturing and talking to younger designers. What do you say to younger women about that and when they're starting to make their way in the world?
I think the thing that made the massive difference for me was that I met very, very early on Ray Smith and Vicky Mortimer. And I think that having a safe space where I could see what was going on for what it was really important. It didn't make it go away, but it also made me know that everything wasn't my fault. It wasn't my problem. And there's something quite empowering about that. And also having women that I could work with who I could be vulnerable with was really important to me, like my relationship with Marianne and then on into Bunny and people like that, you know, that we could be as close as possible our own true selves in those rooms. Likewise with someone like Katie Rudd, you know, sort of seeing that conversation carry on, or Miranda Cromwell, or, you know, it makes such a difference being in a room. And I'm not saying I only want to work with women. You know, some of my best friends are men. But, I've had brilliant creative collaborations with men, but always having that space to regroup to.
Yeah.
You know, Vicky is my closest friend in the world. It somewhere to kind of express your doubts and your fears and to explore those feelings that a lot of the time we sort of don't give shape or form to. So I think that's one of the things that I've done or try to do with some of the younger women that I talk to is give them a space where they can say, this feels a bit weird, or, you know, am I being judged for that or whatever? So acknowledging it is sort of, the only thing I have in terms of combating it is a CV, really.
Yeah, but that is the biggest, like, screw you, you could have, really, isn't it?
Somebody said to me once, what's your proudest achievement? And I said, surviving.
Yeah. To have that CV, let alone the accolades, the Olivier's and, you know, everything else, and to have done it for so long at such a consistently high level, it is a really extraordinary thing, which feels like I'm wrapping up, but actually I want to just take a real swerve and go right back to the beginning, just because I love the story of your kind of first lighting job. I'm sure you've told it loads of times, but can you just tell me how you got your first job as a follow spot operator?
So I was at Goldsmiths College doing an English with drama degree by that stage. And my flatmate was a Guildhall trained stage manager. And, you know, we're talking about 1986, 87, before anyone, we didn't have mobile phones or anything. Anyway, she fell madly in love with this guy called Crispin and disappeared off to Spain for the summer. And the phone went in the flat just when I was thinking I've got to go and sign on, because we could in those days. And it was somebody saying, could you remind Jackie that her call is 9 o'clock tomorrow morning at the Hackney Empire? And I have, to this day, I have no idea what I said, why I did this, but I just said, yep, fine. And I turned up the next day and I pretended to be her. And I knew nothing. I knew absolutely nothing. I'd barely been behind a light. I'd done a little bit of, you know, kind of helping out backstage and things. And I went up to the gods, because this is before they refurbished the Hackney Empire. And I looked across, and the other follow spot operator, amazingly, was a woman called Fiona Simpson. And I went over and I went, I'm not Jackie, and I've got no idea what I'm doing. And she said, it's fine, I'll talk you down. And she looked after me, and it was sort of love at first light, really. So that's where it all started.
It's such a good story. And then everything that followed from there, which is incredible. I want to just finish with a couple of maybe specific examples of things. I think you've talked a lot about essentially the fundamental thing that you're doing as a lighting designer is telling stories, or helping to tell stories, lighting as storytelling. Maybe we could pick on a couple of specific examples of that. So are there, you know, maybe we'll pick two productions where you feel that that's really been the case. Is there anything that sort of comes to mind there?
I mean, the obvious ones that I talk about a lot because people know them are things like War Horse and Curious Incident.
Mm.
I mean, if you think, so let's talk about War Horse, for example. So Ray's design for War Horse is what we call a composite design. So it doesn't change. It's there's a tear above the stage, a kind of cloud, a kind of rip out of paper and a floor. And that's essentially it. So every change in place, time, quality of space is going to be carried by lighting. So you are carrying the story from one place to another, literally. But the brilliant thing about War Horse, of course, is set in the, when it was First World War. The First World War was when the government sent artists to go and express war in painting. So we went from a kind of Edwardian, sort of very kind of nostalgic, sort of figurative form of painting, absolutely recognizable. You know, even back to, I mean, I know it's Constable and Turner earlier, but that tradition of landscape and nostalgia and warmth and, you know, and beauty. And that's shattered by the First World War. And the artists found it so hard to express that they developed these kind of abstract means of expression. So for me, with the lighting, the beginning when we're in Devon, all the tones are warm. All the light comes from distance. I love cloud shadows. I love looking across landscapes and seeing cloud shadows. And that first half is all about pushing light in directions in the way that light goes past shadows and across a landscape. And I want you to fall in love. And I want this horse to be sentient and kind of three-dimensional and like something you genuinely engage with. And then when we went to the war, to the trenches, suddenly all the lights are much, much lower. They're coming at you from angles. There are lots of different types of light sources that are much more chemical. So acid colours, sort of blues, greens, yellow, sulphur, gas, coming at you in shards, sort of hitting the audience in quite an aggressive way. So that's a really simple example of kind of two worlds that I'm holding in contrast, and that's all being carried by the light.
That's amazing. Why don't, is there a production that feels completely different to that then? Maybe something that's at the, you know, complete other end of the spectrum?
It would have to be something. I mean, I also, you know, the irony is that I love nothing more than doing nothing. I love it when you can create a sort of gesture in a space and that's sort of what holds the space. So let me think of a show where I've done that recently where you go, convince me that I need to do anything. Well, okay, Second Best, which is a little show I did at Riverside with Asa Butterfield, and it's Fly designed this kind of gallery space. It's a white cube. And for me, the most important thing for the audience is that the white cube was credible. It's like you would not have lights changing and going off and on and things in a gallery unless it was part of the installation within the gallery. So I just kind of went, what we do is we make that space the whitest, purest, boldest, cleanest space that we possibly can. And we let that story has to land in that space for the audience to believe it. It's very exposing for Asa, you know, for a first-time performer, really tough. You know, I'm not going to carry him from moment to moment, but actually the aesthetic of this space means that we shouldn't really be doing that.
It's so interesting talking about that because I saw that production and I, you know, that set's fantastic. It was really strange. It felt quite David Lynch-y to me where you had like, there was a hospital bed just halfway up the wall.
Yeah.
And you know, and there was a TV at the back center stage, wasn't there? And there was, wasn't there a kind of shopping display that had been knocked over or something? Am I remembering that right?
Totally.
And, you know, you're wondering what all these strange elements are. And it's this kind of dream space, headspace that it seems to be taking place in. But I hadn't, it's so interesting because as a critic, you know, it's these things which seem blindingly obvious once Paulie explains them to me. But I just don't pick up on at the time, which is how exposing it was for Asa.
Oh,
because
God.
There is something subconscious there. You're looking at Asa and thinking, poor guy, like, first production, you know, first stage role, it feels really nerve-wracking. And that's the reason it felt so nerve-wracking. Is
yeah, it feels like a tightrope.
Bright, white space the whole thing. Paulie, thank you so much for talking to me. I absolutely love talking to you about lighting. It just makes so much sense of it for me. So I'm really, really grateful to you for taking the time for this.
An absolute pleasure.